We're gonna walk the track, stay up all night. If we get a little bored, then we'll have a little fight.
Are we all on? Duddits asks.
He has a cone of blue cotton candy in one hand, but it is forgotten. As he watches the stilt-walking cowboy pass under the burning fireworks sky, his eyes are as wide as any three-year-old's. Standing on one side of Duddits are Pete and Jonesy. On the other are Henry and the Beeve. Behind the cowboy comes a retinue of Vestal virgins. Surely some of them are still virgins, even in this year of grace, 1981, in spangly cowboy skirts and white cowboy boots, tossing the batons that won the West.
"Don't know how we can be so tall, Duds," Pete says, laughing.
He yanks a hank of blue floss from the cone in Duddits's hand and tucks it into Duddits's amazed mouth.
"Must be magic."
They all laugh at how Duddits chews without even taking his eyes from the cowpoke on stilts. Duds is taller than all of them now, even taller than Henry, but he's still just a kid, and he makes them all happy. Magic is what he is. He won't find Josie Rinkenhauer for another year, but they know he's fucking magic. It was scary going up against Richie Grenadeau and his friends, but that was still the luckiest day of their lives. They all think so.
"Don't say no, baby. Come with me. You're gonna take a little ride on the CNC. "Hey, Tex!"
Beaver shouts, waving his own lid, a Derry Tigers baseball hat, up at the tall cowboy.
"Kiss my bender, big boy! I mean, sit on it and spin!"
And they're all killing themselves laughing. It is a memory for the ages, all right, the night Beaver ranked on the stilt-walking cowboy in the Derry Days parade beneath that burning gunpowder sky. All but Duddits, who is staring with that expression of stoned wonder. And Owen Underhill. "Owen," Henry thinks. "How did you get here, buddy?" Who looks worried. Owen is shaking him. Owen is once more telling him to wake up.
"Henry, wake up! Wake up, for God's sake!"
It was the fright in Owen's voice that finally roused Henry from his dream. For a moment, he could still smell peanuts and Duddits's cotton candy. Then the world came back in. White sky, snow-covered turnpike lanes, a green sign reading Augusta, next two exits. Also, Owen shaking him, and from behind them, a barking sound, hoarse and desperate. Duddits coughing.
"Wake up, Henry. He's bleeding. Will you please wake the fuck?"
"I'm awake. I'm awake."
He unbuckled his seatbelt, twisted around, got up on his knees. The overstrained muscles in his thighs shrieked in protest, but Henry paid no attention. It was better than he expected. From the panic in Owen's voice, he had expected some sort of hemorrhage, but it was just a trickle from one nostril and a fine spray of blood from Duddits's mouth when he coughed. Owen had probably thought poor old Duds was coughing up his lungs, when in fact he'd probably strained something in his throat. Not that this wasn't potentially serious. In Duddits's increasingly fragile condition, anything was potentially serious. A random cold germ could kill him. From the moment he'd seen him, Henry had known Duds was coming out of the last turn and heading for home.
"Duds!"
he called sharply. Something different. Something different in him, Henry.
What?
No time to think about it now.
"Duddits, breathe in through your nose. Your nose, Duds, like this."
Henry demonstrated taking big breaths through flared nostrils, and when he exhaled, little threads of white flew from his nostrils, like the fluff in milkweed pods or dandelions gone to seed. Virus, Henry thought. It was growing up my nose, but now it's dead. I'm sloughing it off, literally breath by breath. And then he understood the difference. The itching had stopped, in his leg and in his mouth and in the thatch of his groin. His mouth still tasted as if it had been lined with someone's old carpet, but it didn't itch. Duddits began to imitate him, breathing deep through his nose, and his coughing began to ease as soon as he did. Henry took his paper bag, found a bottle of harmless no-alcohol cough medicine, and poured Duddits a capful.
"This'll take care of you," Henry said.
Confidence in the thought as well as the words. With Duddits, how you sounded was only part of it. Duddits drank the capful of Robitussin, grimaced, then smiled at Henry. The coughing had stopped, but blood was still trickling from one nostril, and from the corner of one eye as well, Henry saw. Not good. Nor was Duddits's extreme pallor much more noticeable than it had been at the house back in Derry. The cold, his lost night's sleep, all this untoward excitement in someone who was an invalid. Not good. He was getting sick, and in a late-stage ALL patient, even a nasal infection could be fatal. "You all right?" Owen asked. "Duds? Duds is iron. Right, Duddits?"
"Iron,"
Duddits agreed, and flexed one woefully skinny arm. The sight of his face, thin and tired, but still trying to smile, made Henry feel like screaming. Life was unfair. That was something he supposed he'd known for years. But this went far beyond unfair. This was monstrous.
"Let's see what she put in here for good boys to drink."
Henry took the yellow lunchbox. Duddits said. He was smiling, but his voice sounded thin and exhausted.
"Yep, got some work to do now," Henry agreed, and opened the thermos.
He gave Duds his morning prednisone tablet, although it hadn't yet gone 8, and then asked Duddits if he wanted a Percocet as well. Duddits thought about it, then held up 2 fingers. Henry's heart sank.
"Pretty bad, huh?"
he asked, passing Duddits a couple of Percocet tablets over the seat between them. He hardly needed an answer. People like Duddits didn't ask for the extra pill so they could get high. Duddits made a seesawing gesture with his hand, come see, come sa. Henry remembered it well, that seesawing hand as much a part of Pete as the chewed pencils and toothpicks were of Beaver. Roberta had filled Duddits's thermos with chocolate milk, his favorite. Henry poured him a cup, held it a moment as the Humvee skidded on a slick patch, then handed it over. Duddits took his pills.
"Where does it hurt, Duds?"
"Here."
Hand to the throat.
"More here."
Hand to the chest. Hesitating, coloring a little, then a hand to his crotch.
"Here who?"
A urinary tract infection, Henry thought. Oh, goody.
"Yells ahy, Anna?"
Henry nodded. "Pills will make you better. Just give 'em a chance to work." "Are we still on the line, Duddits?" Duddits nodded emphatically and pointed through the windshield. Henry wondered, not for the first time, just what he saw. Once he'd asked Pete, who told him it was something like a thread, often faint and hard to see.
"It's best when it's yellow," Pete had said. "Yellow's always easier to pick up. I don't know why."
And if Pete saw a yellow thread, perhaps Duddits saw something like a broad yellow stripe, perhaps even Dorothy's yellow brick road. "If it goes off on another road, you tell us, okay?"
"I tell."
"Not going to sleep, are you?" Duddits shook his head. In fact, he had never looked more alive and awake, his eyes glowing in his exhausted face. Henry thought of how light bulbs would sometimes go mysteriously bright before burning out for good.
"If you do start to get sleepy, you tell me, and we'll pull over. Get you some coffee. We need you awake."
"Away."
Henry started to turn around, moving his aching body with as much care as he could muster, when Duddits said something else.
"This ain't aching."
"Does he now?" Henry said thoughtfully.
"What?" Owen asked.
"I didn't get that one."
"He says Mr. Gray wants bacon."
"Is that important?"
"I don't know. Is there a regular radio in this heap, Owen? I'd like to get some news."
The regular radio was hanging under the dash and looked freshly installed, not part of the original equipment. Owen reached for it, then hit the brakes as a Pontiac sedan, 2-wheel drive and no snow tires, cut in front of them. The Pontiac slewed from side to side, finally decided to stay on the road a little longer, and squirted ahead. Soon, it was doing at least 60, Henry estimated, and was pulling away. Owen was frowning after it.
"You driver, me passenger," Henry said, "but if that guy can do it with no snows, why can't we? It might be a good idea to make up some ground.
Hummers are better in mud than snow, take my word for it.
Still,
also, we're going to pass that guy in the next 10 minutes. I'll bet you a quart of good scotch. He'll either be through the guardrails and down the embankment,
or spun out on the median. If he's lucky, he'll be right side up. Plus, this is just a technicality, we're fugitives running from duly constituted authority, and we can't save the world if we're locked up in some county. Jesus! A Ford Explorer. Four-wheel drive, but moving far too fast for the conditions, maybe 70 miles an hour, roared past them, pulling a rooster tail of snow. The roof rack had been piled high and covered with a blue tarp. This had been indifferently lashed down, and Henry could see what was beneath. Luggage. He guessed that much of it would soon be in the road. With Duddett's seen to, Henry took a clear-eyed look at the highway. What he saw did not exactly surprise him. Although the turnpike's northern barrel was still all but deserted, the southbound lanes were now filling up fast, and yes, there were cars off it everywhere. Owen turned on the radio as a Mercedes hurried past him, throwing up fans of slush. He hit Seek, found classical music, hit it again, found Kenny G tootling away, hit it a third time, and happened on a voice.
"Great big fucking bomber joint," the voice said, and Henry exchanged a glance with Owen.
"He say huck on the radio,"
Duddett's observed from the back seat. "That's right," Henry said, and, as the owner of the voice inhaled audibly into the mic, "also I'd say he's smoking a fatty."
"I doubt if the FCC would be in favor," the DJ said after a long and noisy exhale. "But if half of what I'm hearing is true, the FCC is the least of my worries. Interstellar plague on the loose, brothers and sisters, that's the word. Call it the hot zone, the dead zone, or the twilight zone. You want to cancel your trip up north."
Another long and noisy inhale.
"Marvin the Martian's on the march, brothers and sisters. That's the word from Somerset County and Castle County. Plague, death rays, the living will envy the dead. I got a spot here for Century Tire, but fuck that shit."
Sound of something breaking, plastic from the sound. Henry listened, fascinated. Here it was, once more. Here was darkness, his old friend. Not in his head, but on the goddamn radio.
"Brethren and sistren, if you're north of Augusta right now, here's a little tip from your pal Lonesome Dave at WWVE. Relocate south, like immediately. And here's a little relocation music."
Lonesome Dave at WWVE spun the doors, of course. Jim Morrison droning, "The End." Owen switched to the AM band. Eventually, he found a newscast. The fellow giving it didn't sound wrecked, which was a step forward, and he said there was no need to panic, which was another step forward. He then played sound bites from both the president and Maine's governor, both saying essentially the same thing. "Take it easy, people. Chill. It's all under control." Nice, soothing stuff. Robitussin for the body politic. The president was scheduled to make a complete report to the American people at 11 a.m. EST. "It'll be the speech Kurtz told me about," Owen said. "Just moved up a day or so." "What speech is..."
"Shh,"
Owen pointed to the radio. Having soothed, the newscaster next proceeded to stir his listeners up again by repeating many of the rumors they had already heard from the stoned FM jock, only in politer language. Plague, non-human invaders from space, death rays. Then the weather. Snow showers, followed by rain and gusty winds, as a warm front, not to mention the killer Martians, moved in. There was a meep, and then the newscast they'd just heard began playing again.
"Look,"
Duddett said.
"Hey, and Ayas, Ember."
He was pointing through the dirty window. The pointing finger, like Duddett's voice, wouldn't hold steady. He was shivering now, his teeth clittering together. Owen glanced briefly at the Pontiac. It had indeed ended up on the snowy median strip between the northbound and southbound barrels, and although it hadn't rolled all the way over, it was on its side with its disconsolate passengers standing around it, and then looked back at Duddett's. Paler than ever now, shivering, a blood-streaked fluff of cotton protruding from one nostril. "Henry, is he all right?"
"I don't know."
"Run out your tongue. Don't you think you better keep your eyes on...
I'm fine, so don't sass me. Run out your tongue.
Henry did. Owen looked at it and grimaced.
Looks worse, but it's probably better. All that crap has turned white.
Same with the gash on my leg. Same with your face and eyebrows. We're just lucky we didn't get it in the lungs or the brain or the gut.
He paused.
Perlmutter.
Got it in the gut. He's growing one of those things.
How far back are they, Henry?
I'd say 20 miles, maybe a little less. So if you could goose it, even if just a little.
Owen did, knowing that Kurtz would, as soon as he realized he was now part of a general exodus and much less likely to become a target of either the civilian or the military police.
You're still in touch with Pearlie, Owen said. Even though the virus is dying on you, you're still hooked up.
Is it?
He lifted a thumb to the back seat, where Duddits was leaning back. His shakes had eased, at least for the time being.
Sure, Henry said. I had stuff from Duddits long before all this happened. Jonesy, Pete, and Beaver did, too. We hardly noticed. It was just a part of our lives.
Sure, that's right. Like all those thoughts about plastic bags and bridge abutments and shotguns. Just a part of my life.
Now it's stronger. Maybe in time it'll drop back, but for now, he shrugged. For now, I hear voices.
Pearlie.
For one, Henry agreed.
Others with the virus in its active stage, too, mostly behind us.
Jonesy? Your friend Jonesy? Or Gray?
Henry shook his head.
But Pearlie hears something.
Pearlie? How can he...
He's got more mental range than I do right now because of the Byram.
The what?
That thing that's up his ass, Henry said. The shit weasel.
Oh.
Owen felt momentarily sick to his stomach.
What he hears doesn't seem to be human. I don't think it's Mr. Gray, but I suppose it might be.
Whatever it is, he's homing on it.
They drove in silence for a while. The traffic was moderately heavy, and some of the drivers were wild. They passed the Explorer just south of Augusta, ditched and apparently abandoned, with its load of luggage spread around it. But Owen counted himself lucky. The storm had kept plenty of folks off the road, he guessed. They might decide to flee now that the storm had stopped, but he and Henry had gotten ahead of the worst of the wave. In many ways, the storm had been their friend.
I want you to know something, Owen said finally.
You don't need to say it. You're sitting right next to me, short range, and I'm still getting some of your thoughts.
What Owen was thinking was that he would pull the Humvee over and get out if he thought the pursuit would end once Kurtz had him. Owen did not, in fact, believe that. Owen Underhill was Kurtz's prime objective, but Kurtz understood that Owen wouldn't have committed such a monstrous act of treason had he not been coerced into it. No, he'd put a bullet in Owen's head and then continue on. With Owen, Henry had at least some chance. Without him, he'd likely be a dead duck. And Duddits, too.
We stay together, Henry said.
Friends to the end, as the saying goes. And from the back seat,
Awesome, go do now.
That's right, Duds.
Henry reached back and briefly squeezed Duddits's cold hand.
Got some work to do now.
10 minutes later, Duddits came fully to life, pointing them into the first turnpike rest area below Augusta. They were almost to Lewiston now, in fact.
Ein!
He shouted, then began to cough again.
Take it easy, Duddits, Henry said.
They probably stopped for coffee and a Danish, Owen said, or maybe a bacon sandwich.
But Duddits directed them around the back to the employees' parking lot. Here they stopped, and Duddits got out. He stood quiet and muttering for a moment or so, looking frail under the cloudy sky and seemingly buffeted by every gust of wind.
Henry, Owen said, I don't know what bee he's got in his bonnet, but if Kurtz is really close...
But then, Duddits nodded, got back in the Hummer, and pointed toward the exit sign. He looked more tired than ever, but he also looked satisfied.
What in God's name was that all about? Owen asked, mystified.
I think he switched cars, Henry said.
Is that what he did, Duddits? Did he switch cars?
Duddits nodded emphatically.
Toll! A car!
He'll be moving faster now, Henry said.
You've got to step it up, Owen.
Never mind Kurtz, we've got to catch Mr. Gray.
Owen looked over at Henry, then looked again. What's wrong with you? You've come over all pale.
I've been very stupid. I should have known what the bastard was up to from the first. My only excuses are being tired and scared, and none of that will matter if...
Owen, you have to catch him. He's headed for Western Massachusetts, and you have to catch him before he can get there.
Now they were running in slush, and the going was messy, but far less dangerous. Owen walked the Hummer up to 65, all he dared for now.
I'll try, he said, but unless he has an accident or a breakdown...
Owen shook his head slowly back and forth.
I don't think so, pal. I really don't.
This was a dream he'd had often as a child when his name had been Kuntz, but only once or twice since the squirts and sweats of adolescence. In it, he was running through a field under a harvest moon and afraid to look behind him because it was after him. It. He ran as hard as he could, but of course that wasn't good enough. In dreams, your best never is. Then it was close enough for him to hear its dry breathing, and to smell its peculiar dry smell. He came to the shore of a great still lake, although there had never been any lakes in the dry and miserable Kansas town of his childhood, and although it was very beautiful, the moon burned in its depth like a lamp, it terrified him, because it blocked his way, and he could not swim. He fell on his knees at the shore of the lake. In that way, this dream was exactly like those childhood dreams. But instead of seeing the reflection of it in the still water, the terrible scarecrow man with his stuffed burlap head and pudgy blue-gloved hands, this time he saw Owen Underhill, his face covered with splotches. In the moonlight, the virus looked like great black moles, spongy and shapeless. As a child, he had always wakened at this point, often with his stiff wang wagging, although why such an awful dream would give a kid a stiffy, God alone knew. But this time, the it, Owen, actually touched him, the reflected eyes in the water reproachful, maybe questioning.
Because you disobeyed orders, Buck. Because you crossed the line.
He raised his hand to ward Owen off, to remove that hand, and saw his own hand in the moon glow. It was gray.
No, he told himself. That's just the moonlight.
Only three fingers, though. Was that the moonlight? Owen's hand on him, touching him, passing on his filthy disease, and still daring to call him Boss. Wake up, Boss. Kurtz opened his eyes and sat up with a grunt, simultaneously pushing Freddy's hand away. On his knee instead of his shoulder. Freddy reaching back from his place behind the wheel and shaking his knee, but still intolerable.
I'm awake, I'm awake.
He held his own hands up in front of his face to prove it. Not baby pink, they were a long way from that, but they weren't gray, and each had the requisite five fingers.
What time is it, Freddy?
Don't know, boss. Still morning's all I can say for sure. Of course, clock's all fucked up. Even his pocket watch had run down. As much a victim of modern times as anyone else, he had forgotten to wind it. To Kurtz, whose time sense had always been at least fairly sharp, it felt like about 9, which would mean he'd gotten about 2 hours of shut-eye. Not much, but he didn't need much. He felt better. Well enough, certainly, to hear the concern in Freddy's voice.
What's up, bucko?
Pearly says he's lost contact with all of them now. He says Owen was the last, and now he's gone, too. He says Owen must have beat back the Ripley fungus, sir. Kurtz caught sight of Perlmutter's sunken I-fooled-you grin in the wide rearview mirror.
What's the deal, Archie?
No deal, Pearly said, sounding considerably more lucid than before Kurtz's nap.
Boss, I could use a drink of water. I'm not hungry, but...
We could stop for water, I guess, Kurtz allowed. If we had a contact, that is. But if we've lost all of them, this guy Jones as well as Owen and Devlin, well, you know how I am, Buck. I'll bite when I die, and it'll take two surgeons and a shotgun to get me to let go even then.
You're going to have a long and thirsty day sitting there while Freddie and I course the southbound roads looking for a trace of them, unless you can help out. You do that, Archie, and I'll order Freddie to pull off at the next exit. I will personally trot into the stop-and-go or 7-Eleven and buy you the biggest bottle of Poland Spring water in the cooler. How's that sound?
It sounded good. Kurtz could tell that just by the way Perlmutter first smacked his lips and then ran his tongue out to wet them. On Perlmutter's lips and cheeks, the Ripley was still full and rich, most patches the color of strawberries, some as dark as burgundy wine. But that sly look had come back. His eyes, rimmed with crusts of Ripley, darted from side to side. And all at once, Kurtz understood the picture he was looking at. Pearlie had gone crazy, God love him. Perhaps it took one to know one.
I told him the God's truth. I'm out of touch with all of them now.
But then Archie laid his finger alongside his nose and looked slyly up into the mirror again.
We catch them. I think there's a good chance we can get you cured up, laddie.
Kurtz said this in his driest, just-making-my-report voice.
Now, which of them are you still in touch with? Jonesy? Or is it the new one?
Dud Dutz.
Not him. None of them.
But still the finger by the nose, still the sly look.
Tell me, and you get water, Kurtz said. Continue to yank my crank, soldier, and I will put a bullet in you and roll you out into the snow. Now you go on and read my mind and tell me that's not so.
Pearlie looked at him sulkily in the rearview mirror a moment longer, and then said,
Jonesy and Mr. Gray are still on the turnpike. They're down around Portland now. Jonesy told Mr. Gray how to go around the city on 295, only it isn't like telling. Mr. Gray is in his head, and when he wants something, I think he just takes it.
Kurtz listened to this with mounting awe, all the time calculating.
There's a dog, Pearlie said. They have a dog with them. His name is Lad. He's the one I'm in contact with. He's like me.
His eyes met Kurtz's again in the mirror, only this time the slyness was gone. In its place was a miserable half-sanity.
Do you think there's really a chance I could be, you know, myself again?
Knowing that Perlmutter could see into his mind made Kurtz proceed cautiously.
I think there's a chance you could be delivered of your burden, at least, with a doctor in attendance who understands the situation. Yes, I think that could be. A big whiff of chloro, and when you wake up, poof.
Kurtz kissed the ends of his fingers, then turned to Freddy.
If they're in Portland, what's their lead on us?
Maybe 70 miles, boss.
Then step it up a little, praise Jesus. Don't put us in the ditch, but step it up.
70 miles. And if Owen and Devlin and Dud Dutz knew what Archie Perlmutter knew, they were still on track.
Let me get this straight, Archie. Mr. Gray is in Jonesy.
Yes.
And they have a dog with them that can read their minds?
The dog hears their thoughts, but he doesn't understand them. He's still only a dog.
Boss, I'm thirsty.
He's listening to the dog like it's a fucking radio, Kurtz marveled. Freddy, next exit, drinks all around. He resented having to make a pit stop, resented losing even a couple of miles on Owen, but he needed Perlmutter, happy if possible. Up ahead was the rest area where Mr. Gray had traded his plow for the cook's Subaru, where Owen and Henry had also briefly pulled in because the line went in there. The parking lot was crammed, but among the three of them, they had enough change for the vending machines out front. Praise God. Whatever the triumphs and failures of the so-called Florida presidency, that record is in large part still unwritten, there will always be this. He put an end to the space scare with his speech that November morning. There were differing views on why the speech worked. It wasn't leadership, it was timing, one critic sniffed. But it did work.
hungry for hard information, people who were already on the run pulled off the highway to see the president speak. Appliance stores in malls filled up with crowds of silent, staring people. At the food fuel stops along I-95, the counters shut down. TVs were placed beside the quiet cash registers. Bars filled up. In many places, people threw their homes open to others who wanted to watch the speech. They could have listened on their car radios, as Jonesy and Mr. Gray did, and kept on trucking, but only a minority did. Most people wanted to see the leader's face. According to the president's detractors, the speech did nothing but break the momentum of the panic.
Porky Pig could have given a speech at that particular time and gotten that particular result, one of them opined.
Another took a different view.
It was a pivotal moment in the crisis, this fellow said. There were maybe 6,000 people on the road. If the president had said the wrong thing, there would have been 60,000 by 2 in the afternoon and maybe 600,000 by the time the wave hit New York, the biggest wave of DPs since the Dust Bowl. The American people, especially those in New England, came to their narrowly elected leader for help, for comfort and reassurance. He responded with what may have been the greatest My Fellow Americans speech of all time. Simple as that.
Simple or not, sociology or great leadership, the speech was about what Owen and Henry had expected, and Kurtz could have predicted every word and turn. At the center were two simple ideas, both presented as absolute facts, and both calculated to soothe the terror which beat that morning in the ordinarily complacent American breast. The first idea was that, while they had not come waving olive branches and handing out free introductory gifts, the newcomers had evinced absolutely no signs of aggressive or hostile behavior. The second was that, while they had brought some sort of virus with them, it had been contained within the Jefferson Tract. The president pointed it out on a chroma key green screen, as adeptly as any weatherman pointing out a low-pressure system. And even there, it was dying, with absolutely no help from the scientists and military experts who were on the scene.
"Well, we cannot say for sure at this juncture," the president told his breathless watchers.
Those who found themselves at the New England end of the Northeast Corridor were, perhaps understandably, the most breathless of all.
"We believe that our visitors brought this virus with them, as much as travelers from abroad may bring certain insects into their country of origin in their luggage or on produce they've purchased. This is something customs officials look for, but of course,"
big smile from Great White Father,
"our recent visitors did not pass through a customs checkpoint."
Yes, a few people had succumbed to the virus. Most were military personnel. The great majority of those who contracted it, "a fungal growth not unlike athlete's foot," said the Great White Father, "beat it quite easily on their own. A quarantine had been imposed around the area, but the people outside that zone were in no danger. Repeat, no danger. If you are in Maine and have left your homes," said the president, "I suggest you return. In the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we have nothing to fear but fear itself." Nothing about the slaughter of the Gray Boys, the blown ship, the interred hunters, the fire at Goslin's, or the breakout. Nothing about the last of Gallagher's Imperial Valleys being hunted down like dogs. They were dogs in the view of many, worse than dogs. Nothing about Kurtz, and not a whisper about Typhoid Jonesy. The president gave them just enough to break the back of the panic before it surged out of control. Most people followed his advice and went home. For some, of course, this was impossible. For some, home had been canceled. The little parade moved south under dark skies, led by the rusty red Subaru that Marie Turgeon of Litchfield would never see again. Henry, Owen, and Duddits were 55 miles or about 50 minutes behind. Pulling out of the Mile 81 rest area, Pearlie was greedily glugging down his second bottle of Naya water by the time they rejoined the traffic flow. Kurtz and his men were roughly 75 miles behind Jonesy and Mr. Gray, 20 miles behind Kurtz's prime quarry. If not for the cloud cover, a spotter in a low-flying plane might have been able to see all three at the same time, the Subaru
and both Humvees at 11:43 EST when the president finished his speech by saying, "God bless you, my fellow Americans, and God bless America." Jonesy and Mr. Gray were crossing the Kittery-Portsmouth Bridge into New Hampshire. Henry, Owen, and Duddits were passing Exit 9, which gives access to the communities of Falmouth, Cumberland, and Jerusalem's Lot. Kurtz, Freddy, and Perlmutter's belly was swelling again. He lay back groaning and passing noxious gas, perhaps a kind of critical comment on the Great White Father's speech. We're near the Bodenham exit of 295, not far north of Brunswick. All three vehicles would have been easy enough to pick out because so many people had pulled in somewhere to watch the president give his soothing chroma key-aided lecture. Drawing on Jonesy's admirably organized memories, Mr. Gray left 95 for 495 just after crossing over the New Hampshire-Massachusetts border, and, directed by Duddits, who saw Jonesy's passage as a bright yellow line, the lead Humvee would follow. At the town of Marlborough, Mr. Gray would leave 495 for I-90, one of America's major east-west highways. In the Bay State, this road is known as the Mass Pike. Exit 8, according to Jonesy, was marked Palmer, UMass, Amherst, and Ware. 6 miles beyond Ware was the Quabbin. Shaft 12 was what he wanted. Jonesy said so, and Jonesy couldn't lie, as much as he might have liked to. There was a Massachusetts Water Authority office at the Windsor Dam on the south side of the Quabbin Reservoir. Jonesy could get him that far, and then Mr. Gray would do the rest. Jonesy couldn't sit behind the desk anymore. If he did, he'd start to blubber. From blubbering, he would no doubt progress to gibbering. From gibbering to yammering, and once he started to yammer, he'd probably be out and rushing into Mr. Gray's arms, totally bonkers and ready to be extinguished. "Where are we now, anyway?" he wondered. "Marlborough yet? Leaving 495 for 90? That sounds about right." Not that there was any way to tell for sure with his window shuttered. Jonesy looked at the window and grinned in spite of himself. Had to. Give up, come out, had been replaced with what he'd been thinking of. Surrender Dorothy. "I did that," he thought. "And I bet I could make the goddamn shutters vanish if I wanted to." And so what? Mr. Gray would put up another set, or maybe just slop some black paint on the glass. If he didn't want Jonesy looking out, Jonesy would stay blind. But the point was, Mr. Gray controlled the outside part of him. Mr. Gray's head had exploded. He'd sporulated right in front of Jonesy's eyes. Dr. Jekyll turns into Mr. Byrus, and Jonesy had inhaled him. Now, Mr. Gray was... He's a pain, Jonesy thought. Mr. Gray is the pain in my brain. Something tried to protest this view, and he actually had a coherent dissenting thought. No, you've got it all backwards. You were the one who got out, who escaped. But he pushed it away. That was pseudo-intuitive bullshit, a cognitive hallucination not much different than a thirsty man seeing a non-existent oasis in the desert. He was locked in here. Mr. Gray was out there eating bacon and ruling the roost. If Jonesy allowed himself to think differently, he'd be an April fool in November. Got to slow him down. If I can't stop him, is there a way I can at least throw a monkey wrench into the works? He got up and began to walk around the edge of the office. It was 34 paces. Hell of a short round trip. Still, he supposed, it was bigger than your average jail cell. Guys in Walpole or Danvers or Shawshank would think this was the cat's ass. In the middle of the room, the dreamcatcher danced and turned. One part of Jonesy's mind counted paces. The other wondered how close they were getting to exit 8 of the Mass Pike. 31, 32, 33, 34. And here he was, back behind his chair again. Time for round 2. They'd be in Ware soon enough. Not that they'd stop there. Unlike the Russian woman, Mr. Gray knew exactly where he wanted to go. 32, 33, 34, 35, 36. Behind his chair again, and ready for another spin. He and Carla had had 3 children by the time they turned 30. Number 4 had come less than a year ago, and neither of them had expected to own a summer cottage, not even a modest one like the place on Osborne Road in North Ware anytime soon. Then there had been a seismic shift in Jonesy's department. A good friend had assumed the chairmanship, and Jonesy had found himself an associate professor at least 3 years earlier than his most optimistic expectations. The salary bump had been considerable. 35, 36, 37, 38, and behind his chair again. This was good. It was pacing the cell, no more than that, but it was calming him. That same year, Carla's grandmother had passed away, and there had been a considerable estate settled between Carla and her sister, as the close blood kin in the intervening generation had died. So, they got the cottage, and that first summer, they'd taken the kids up to the Windsor Dam. From there, they'd gone on one of the regularly scheduled summer tours. Their guide, an MWA employee in a forest green uniform, had told them the area around the Quabbin Reservoir was called the Accidental Wilderness and had become the major nesting area for eagles in Massachusetts. John and Misha, the older kids, had hoped to see an eagle or two, but they'd been disappointed. The reservoir had been formed in the 30s by flooding three farming communities, each with its own little market town. At that time, the land surrounding the new lake had been tame. In the 60 or so years since, it had returned to what all of New England must have been like before the tillage and industry began midway through the 17th century. A tangle of rutted, unpaved roads ran up the east side of the lake, one of the purest reservoirs in North America, their guide had told them, but that was it. If you wanted to go much beyond Shaft 12 on the East Branch, you'd need your hiking shoes. That was what the guide said. Lorington, his name had been. There had been maybe a dozen other people on the tour, and by then they had been about back to their starting place again, standing on the edge of the road which ran across Windsor Dam, looking north at the reservoir, the Quabbin, bright blue in the sunlight, sparkling with a million points of light, Joey fast asleep in the papoose carrier on Jonesy's back. Lorington had been wrapping up his spiel, just about to wish them a nice day, when some guy in a Rutgers sweatshirt had raised his hand like a school kid and said, "Shaft 12, isn't that where the Russian woman..." 38, 39, 40, 41, and back to the desk chair. Counting without really thinking about the numbers, something he did all the time. Carla said it was a sign of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Jonesy didn't know about that, but he knew that the counting was soothing him, and so he set off on another round. Lorington's mouth had tightened at the words, "Russian woman." Not part of the lecture, apparently. Not part of the good vibes the Water Authority wanted visitors to take with them. Depending on which municipal pipes it flowed through during the last 8 or 10 miles of its journey, Boston tap water could be the purest, best tap water in the world. That was the gospel they wanted to spread.
"I really don't know much about that, sir," Lorington had said, and Jonesy had thought, "My goodness, I think a guy just told a whittle fibby wibby."
41, 42, 43. Back behind the chair and ready to start around again. Walking a little faster now, hands clasped behind his back like a ship's captain pacing the foredeck. Or pacing the brig after a successful mutiny. He supposed that was really more like it. Jonesy had been a history teacher most of his life, and curiosity came him as second nature. He had gone to the library one day later that week and had looked for the story in the local paper and had eventually found it. It had been brief and dry. There were stories about lawn parties inside that had more detail and color, but their postman had known more and had been happy to share. Old Mr. Beckwith. Jonesy still remembered his final words before he'd put his blue and white mail truck back in gear and rolled on down Osborne Road to the next rural box. There was a lot of mail to be delivered in the south end of the lake in summertime. Jonesy had walked back to the cottage, their unexpected gift, thinking it was no wonder Lorington hadn't wanted to talk about the Russian woman. Not good public relations at all. Her name is either Elena or Elina Timurova. No one seems sure which. She turns up in Ware in the early fall of 1995 in a Ford Escort with a discreet yellow Hertz sticker on the windshield. The car turns out to be stolen, and a story makes the rounds, unsubstantiated but juicy, that she obtained it at Logan Airport, swapping sex for a set of car keys. Who knows, it could have happened that way. However it happens, she is clearly disoriented, not quite right in the head. Someone remembers the bruise on the side of her face. Someone else, the fact that her blouse is buttoned wrong. Her English is poor,
but good enough for her to get across what she wants, directions to the Quabbin Reservoir. These she writes down, in Russian, on a slip of paper.